You're tuned in to the First Few Moments podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The First Few Moments podcast is the most up-to-date source for responder best practice discussions and incident review. Join industry leaders and seasoned providers at firstfewmoments.com. You can talk to us through Twitter at First Few Moments, email us at podcast@firstfewmoments.com, or call us at 716-245-5FFM.
There's only the one story that I'm able to get from, looks like the AP, or no, this is the Oregonian newspaper, probably the closest paper to the incident. It was reported on gems.com earlier today. So it's not like it's going to be in the Times or anything like that, but getting more details, more information from the crews is going to be nearly impossible. Why? Because of privacy legislation, so... sorry, KDB, I'm looking for that link here.
Not a problem. Actually, you know, we've been having such a great discussion on this. I've actually gone ahead and started to record on this. I want you to welcome everyone to the First Few Moments, your biweekly podcast about managing your scene. Here we discuss safety management, triage, and care. My name is Kyle David Bates, and you've been listening to kind of a discussion we've been having about some unusual motor vehicle crash situations that have been going on around the around the industry, around the field as of late. We've got a couple different stories we're going to talk about on that. And joining me today, some of the voices you've heard. The first is Russ. Russ, how are you?
I am doing excellent.
Well, welcome to it. You just came over from PDU.com on the pediatric head injuries.
That was fun.
That was great. I just sit there and drool listening to Drs. Antivy and Dr. Romig. They're just so smart when it comes to that sort of stuff.
Yeah, they pretty much controlled the whole thing. We were just kind of sitting there like, yeah, okay.
I can't talk. I'm too busy listening to it. I love it.
We'll comment when it comes to a stuff.
Exactly. You can find it over at PDU, PEDI-U.com. That episode should be up here probably in the next week or so. So welcome, Russ. Next is Scott, Mr. Scott Keir. How are you?
Hi, Kyle. How you doing?
Good. Good. How are things out there in Boston, the area, Massachusetts?
It's rather snowy.
Are you still whining?
Yes, I am. I am whining. Hey, by the way, how's your hand? I heard about an unfortunate blender incident this morning.
That was the worst joke.
That was the point.
That was bad.
It was my futile attempt to get my tweet read on XM satellite radio, and I failed miserably.
Did you? Yes. Well, welcome. Welcome, Scott. Next joining us is Mr. Robert. Rob, I can't do your last name tonight. How do you say that?
That's all right, Kyle. It's Rahab.
Rahab. I'm sorry.
Listen, always think of rehab and then say, I don't need that, and it's Rahab. I get that so often, so.
That's good. And you're actually joining us with a little bit of specialty in driving.
I'd like to talk if we can tonight. I know it's a potpourri of topics tonight, and bring your own topics, so. I was thinking maybe one of the things could be the AMR collision and just talking about driver safety and scene safety is one of the topics.
Absolutely, absolutely. We'll definitely do that. And joining us, haven't heard from this gentleman in a while, Mr. Justin Shore, the Happy Medic. How are you?
Good evening. I've been hiding.
You've been hiding? Yeah, where have you been?
I've been in a place called Life.
What is that?
It's very unusual. It's where the wife says, you've been spending way too much time online. And then you just kind of take a half a step back. No, we've been very busy with Chronicles of EMS. If you've been following, it's been kind of quiet on that front lately because we've got so much happening. And every night is either spending time with the family or dealing with Mr. Thaddeus Setla, our illustrious producer. So I haven't been on a podcast that wasn't the crossover. Oh, it's got to be close to 6 months.
I was going to say, definitely haven't been around. I was talking to Ted today, I haven't seen him in a while. We talked to him in quite a bit. You guys have just been going nuts there, taping Seat at the Table.
We have it, and when I sat down in front of the computer, this great thing about social media, a message pops up from Kyle David Bates, says, you want to be on the show? And I said, you know what? I do want to be on the show, so thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for coming. You actually kind of brought up the first topic we're going to be talking about tonight. Just why don't you ahead and lead us off about the parking lot dead guy.
Well, this first popped up on gems.com earlier this morning. Found it through their Facebook status update. This is in Oregon, Portland, Oregon. A police cruiser, later they found out from the security tape, a man crashed his car. 20 minutes later, he was found by a police officer, Pulsus Apnik. The police officers began to give aid. Doesn't say if they had an AED or not. I'm guessing no. Because they sent an officer running 125 feet to the Portland Adventist Medical Center. Again, this is from the story on gems.com, which is taken from the Oregonian newspaper. The officer ran 125 feet to the Portland Adventist Medical Center to seek help. He was told by the emergency room staff that they won't be coming out and to call AMR. And the story goes on to say that the officers were frustrated. The hospital eventually sent a nurse, two security guards, and an AED. And also an ambulance personnel. They don't say if it was an EMT or paramedic from an ambulance that had transported there. This was all happening at just before 1 o'clock in the morning there in Portland. And a lot of folks in the chat room are jumping on the hospital and getting really upset that the hospital didn't send their campus strike team out to handle the incident. But I think we all need to remember that emergency rooms and especially physicians are not trained nor equipped to handle anything outside of the hospital. And the discussion in the chat room it's very interesting to go to gems.com and really take a look at the comments that are in there.
Now, don't they have a legal responsibility under EMTALA?
From my understanding, under EMTALA, they have a legal responsibility to render aid and not refuse aid until that patient is stable. Now, that being said, and we brought up the topic earlier, under EMTALA, I believe it's within 200 feet or a reasonable visual distance for EMTALA to take effect. So you could either see the dumpsters or be near the dumpsters or see the front door of the hospital, and they can't refuse you. Now, them saying, no, we won't treat him and you'll have to call someone else, I think are two completely different things. You know, this would be very similar to imagine we're an EMS staff in the ER dropping off a BLS patient, and all of a sudden a surgeon comes running in and says, "Oh, you're a paramedic, you know cardiology. Come with me, and scrub in." Well, maybe you can, maybe you can't, but that's not your place. That's not your job. You're not equipped for that.
But there's actually no law or legislation that says that we actually ought to do that where, you know, the EMTALA, whether we agree with it in terms of do they have capabilities of or not to do it. I mean, that is their legal responsibility within that number of feet.
Absolutely, but could their legal responsibility be covered by saying you're going to need to call an ambulance who's better suited to care for that patient right now? Or do they grab a hospital bed from the hallway and go running into the parking lot?
That's what I would do.
What the distance was from the door to the parking lot?
It only notes in the article that and this is according to the police officer, that it was 125 feet. And it was in the parking garage. So this could very well arguably be considered, quote unquote, the campus of the hospital for EMTALA. So definitely he would fit under that. Now, it all goes back to my original impression of, was the hospital just saying, oh, we don't have to deal with it? Or were they just saying, we can't deal with it, call the local ambulance company? They're the ones that are experts in this. That's how I read it. And that's how I think I would have handled it had I been on staff at that hospital that night.
I find it kind of, I don't want to say funny, but, you know, as much slack, you know, a hard time that they give us, you know, why don't you have the IV done? Why is this not done? They always think they can do it better than what we can do it, and here they're going, nope, not going to do it.
It wouldn't be prudent.
Oh, jeez.
Well, I mean, how many times have we gone on a call where we get activated by a third party somewhere on the hospital campus, and the hospital, the ER doesn't even know about it? You know, in my jurisdiction, I get called to certain hospitals all the time where people say they refuse to see me. And I say, that's, you know, you're lying to me, number one. Number two, you're still on their campus, so I can't take you anywhere else until you're deemed stable by the physician here. So why don't you just wait? No, I want to go somewhere else. These kind of EMTALA issues come up all the time. And whereas it is designed to make sure that people are not turned away from hospitals, I think in the situation of Portland like we're discussing, I don't think EMTALA even needs to enter into it. Had the officer come running into the ER and the ER said, not our problem, you figure it out, then definitely we'd have an issue.
Now, was this in the – don't remember if you said this or not, but was this in the hospital's parking garage or another parking garage that just happened to be close by?
As far as we can tell from the article, Russ, it is the Portland Adventist Medical Center parking lot or parking garage.
Well, technically, that's physically on their campus.
Absolutely, and that's if it is their parking lot or if you can see the front door again. EMTALA's definition, I think, is still kind of up in the air and for each court to decide. But in this case, absolutely, this patient's on the campus.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That, and I was telling a story, I don't know if Kyle got it or not, but I'll repeat it for the sake of doing so, is that I was contracted to work with Miami Valley Hospital in Dayton, Ohio, and they have a mobile intensive care unit based on the hospital grounds, which is basically, if some people may or may not be familiar, it's basically a big ICU on wheels. And it served as the first response unit for anything that happened on the hospital grounds, even if it was a staff member that went down, you know, physically inside the hospital. The MICU was still required, which is a nurse trained as a paramedic, and a paramedic, and then a driver who was an EMT, we were still required to go to that person that was still physically on the hospital grounds and take them to the emergency room. And it reminds me of a story that we had where we actually had a live birth in the parking garage, which is kind of similar to this, but in a way that we still respond to that, and if that particular hospital had a similar response system, which I'm guessing they didn't because they didn't really know what to do, then, you know, it would make sense that whole system would come into place.
And definitely, if AMR had arrived or whatever ambulance company, municipal service had arrived, loaded the patient, and then requested transport to this facility, Portland Adventist, and was told no, that would certainly be a direct violation of EMTALA. We can all agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Robert, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I understand the legality of it, but and going back with what you're saying about EMTALA and within the campus grounds and everything, but I have to look at it just from a no-nonsense, common-sense approach. And that is, you know, you have a guy who's in cardiac arrest, the least you do is grab a gurney from inside and come out and render aid that way. I don't know why the cops are expecting them to bring the ER out to the patient versus picking up the patient and bringing him back into the ER. It's 125 feet. That's, what, less than 42 yards? That's nothing.
I think it's a clear giveaway that the officers in this community don't know the capabilities of their emergency rooms.
Well, right, and this is in Portland, Oregon, or is this in New York? Because I think we have the same issues.
But also, looking at my municipality, if I have something 125 feet from the front doors of St. Closest, and I know they've got one charge nurse and, you know, two techs and two nurses for 18 beds, if I come running in and say, hurry, I need your only doctor and two nurses and a bed that I'm not even sure you have to run down the street and help this guy out, they're going to look at me like I've got a third arm growing out of my head. They're going to say, it sounds like exactly what you guys deal with every day. Why don't you go deal with it? And I think that's where this ambulance employee that they mentioned in the article went to render aid with a nurse and two security guards and an AED. You know, we're learning from this new team approach for CPR that that's kind of how you can run things. If you have one person that knows what needs to happen and can guide everyone through the process,
right?
Maybe that's the basic intervention we need. But I don't know if this is the third floor of the parking garage and the elevators aren't big enough. You know, there's so many variables to could they get a hospital bed to the patient or not. I would have loved for them to grab an entire, you know, respiratory surgeon, you know, let's get a cardiologist out there and the 12-lead machine and go running out. I mean, how many hospitals would be able to even remove a cardiac monitor from the ward and take it out of the building?
How about this? How about just the simple stuff? What do you deal with every day when you walk into an emergency room? You have IV carts, you have a crash cart. How are you going to get any of that stuff out to the patient? The most prudent way to get the equipment needed to this patient is via an ambulance. I think that
absolutely.
What you're looking at is you're looking at an emergency room that realized their limitations and realized the situations that they had and did the right thing by getting the right tools to the job. The AED got there quickly. Somebody was there to do CPR quickly. Now let's get the next step of the chain of survival in there, and that's early ACLS via an ambulance in this case, who had the right gear and did the right thing for the patient, and the patient didn't survive. That happens.
Scott, let me take you one step back in that chain of survival. Why was there not an AED in the trunk of that police car?
That's a good question.
The Pacific Northwest, you know, we talk about Seattle, we talk about Pierce County and King County, and, you know, whenever I think of Pacific Northwest EMS, I think of public CPR and AEDs hanging from streetlights, and it just sounds like a very early intervention-centered area. And then I find out that, you know, maybe the police officers know CPR, maybe they don't, but there are no AEDs in their trunks. And obviously I'm in my my armchair here going back in time. Putting AEDs in the police car, could it have had a difference? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it will next time.
It's kind of funny when something happens in the ER parking lot where I am and they need something. Guess what they do? They're either grabbing our equipment from our spare equipment room. They're either grabbing an ambulance crew and saying, hey, can you give us a handout here? Because they don't know how to take somebody out of a car. They're not trained how to do that. You know what I mean? And they don't have anything that meets the needs of this situation. So what are they supposed to do?
I think the other thing we have to look at is a couple things. One, from the reports, is only 8 minutes from the time the first officer came into the ER until the patient arrived. But I also kind of want to lead this into the next thing that we kind of talk about. And Justin, I kind of look at you when we're down in Dallas. You were showing the video on mechanism of injury from that. But when you read in this article, this patient did not die of trauma.
No.
He was dead. There was very little trauma to the car. And that's something that I think sometimes we need to look at as providers is that, yes, we have mechanism of injury, or Scott put over here, and the mechanism of idiocy, which we've talked before on earlier podcasts, is you have to, you know, keep an eye out. I mean, he was dead from heart disease. There was no trauma, and that's per the ME's office. Of that. And if he's down for 20 minutes, the likelihood of his survival is negligible. It's probably not even going to happen for that. But, you know, keep an eye out. As you approach these cars, look at it. If you have someone who's not responding or unresponsive or the presentation does not match the vehicle, you need to start thinking about a medical cause on this. Or is there a chemical exposure? You know, something else is going on. What's the issue there?
Yeah, Kyle, you bring up a great point. I don't know if you got it earlier. Same thing Russell was saying. You know, we had a great conversation earlier, and you said you were recording it. But last week, as I was going out as a captain, we had the opportunity to intervene in such a fashion that someone who was suffering a medical condition, who was involved in a traumatic event, we were able to get early ACLS to that patient. Get the monitor on them, find them in VFib, shock them into a perfusible rhythm to the point that in less than 10 minutes, they were regaining consciousness. And, you know, this was nowhere near a hospital. so it wouldn't have even entered into it. But within 4 minutes of the report of accident to our guys on scene, we had ALS there. Not all firehouses in my jurisdiction are ALS all the time. It kind of bumps around, you know, budget cuts these days. But that day, luckily, that engine was ALS.
And I think that's something that's good is you guys got right into it. You guys got right into looking at the cardiac care. And, you know, folks, if you see this accident and there's not a lot of trauma or damage, this car and this person's dead, I would not be so concerned about spinal mobilization and trying to get this guy in a backboard and secured, because the time you waste on that, this person's chance of survivability decreases exponentially.
And at the same time, you know, it's funny, Scott and Kyle, you both mentioned the mechanism of injury, mechanism of idiocy, I believe it was mentioned as. You know, there was this big football game just a little while ago, and judging by some of these hits, every single one of those guys met C-spine criteria for my service.
Oh, really?
But then they got up and ran away. So, you know, we do have these protocols that are 40 years old and are designed to quote unquote keep us safe from what we believe to be the definition of liability. But if you have a more pressing life threat like pulselessness, we can not worry so much about C-spine. Maybe just tell the guy holding the BVM, hey, try not to move around so much.
Right. It's always life over limb.
Absolutely. And Robert, you hit it on the head on the nail right there.
And, you know, the whole deal also is like what Kyle was saying also, is take a look at the mechanism of injury. If you have a report of a car collision with an unresponsive, apneic, and pulseless patient, or was it because of the mechanism? Was the injury that was the collision that caused the cardiac arrest, or was it a cardiac arrest that caused the collision? And that changes the whole game plan from going from trauma to medical. And our counterparts, our coworkers, need to be more aware of looking at the damage and the mechanism of injury, and to sit down and take a shot with that and an educated guess and look at that, and then treat appropriately. Unfortunately, we don't always have that. We don't always know what that is.
Robert, let me ask you a question. This is the first time you and I have spoken. In going through your education, was it kind of a giveaway because you knew you were in cardiac block that the MVA that you were responding to in that scenario in school was going to have a cardiac component? Do you think maybe our education is letting us down by teaching us in blocks? Or do you think this is situational awareness? Where are providers learning this? Is it in the field when it's too late, or are we seeing this in the classroom?
You know, Justin, that's a good point. I don't think we teach enough in the classroom. I think it's pretty much like our whole educational system is teach them to pass the exam. And the unfortunate thing about it is that we are now training a lot of EMTs out there to be parrots. We have them recite things. We have them learn algorithms and learn mnemonics. But a lot of them really don't really understand what that's all about. I've been an instructor for 23 years, and it's always aggravated me when I talk to a student, and they're going through their patient assessment, and they tell me, okay, the patient's eyes are pearl. Like, okay, what does that mean? Do you know what that means? It means his pupils are equal and reactive to light. I go, very good. So what does that mean? What happens when you shine a light in somebody's eyes? What happens? And then I get that look on their face.
I love it when I actually use the word perla.
Yeah, right?
And you mean, Robert, you got the durr moment.
Yeah, I've got the deer claw in the headlights. That's right. And they're like, what do you mean? I said, what happens when you shine a light in their eyes? What happens to the pupil? They get bigger. No, they get small. Wait, okay. Go back into the dark bathroom and shine a light in your eyes and then come back and tell me what happens. It's unbelievable. We have them parroting phrases, but we don't really test to see if they really understand that. And then what it comes down to is, they get out into the field, and it's expected to be taught out there as on-the-job training.
Scene safety, BSI. That's the phrase they all deal with. I'm actually on my way. I'm actually writing a new presentation for a conference called "Scene Safety Stinks," And I absolutely
that's
hate
a good one, Kyle.
Scene safety. And I kind of go more along the lines of, coming from the aeronautical industry, something called situational awareness. Mm-hmm. That you have to be aware of your surroundings 100% of the times, 360 degrees, from the time you come in to the time you go home on that. And I think that is an important thing. And nowhere does that become more important than, you know, driving. I think driving and operating your ambulance, because that's really where we get a lot of situational awareness is operating within the front of the helicopter as we're flying, you know, keeping, you know, watching for other aircraft, birds, planes, all sorts of stuff that can kill us. Something that we keep an eye on. But, you know, with technology coming and working radios, I think we're starting to see a lot more crashes of our ambulance. And on this past Sunday, there was a fatal ambulance accident in Brighton, New York, involving a rural metro ambulance, where one person was killed, and that was the patient. The accident happened about 2:30 in the afternoon. There was snow, and the ambulance was making a left turn when it was hit by an oncoming car. And they were transporting an 82-year-old male patient from a nursing home to a hospital, where it looks like it was a non-emergency trip. I heard that he may have had a cerebral bleed going on or suspected, but there was no lights or sirens on at the time of the crash. And from my report is that it was a pretty significant crash that threw him between the shelving and the stretcher, and he's actually the one that died. If he didn't die on scene, he died shortly thereafter. The car that struck him was driven by an 84-year-old female and her 98-year-old passenger, both taken with serious injuries based on their ages. But the driver of the ambulance was actually ticketed for improper turn on that. And Rob, I'm going to kind of boot this one over to you because you're kind of a resident expert for driving.
Well, you know, Kyle, I didn't get to look at the police report or anything, but reading from what I've heard was that the vehicle that was moving, that was traveling forward, was driven by the 84-year-old female driver, was apparently traveling at a high rate of speed, and that area was allowed for a 30 or 40 mile an hour speed zone, and she was traveling above the speed limit from what I've read in additional literature. The ambulance, though, was on a non-emergent transport and making a left-hand turn. And we all know that, especially in New York, but pretty much across the country, you're making a left, you forfeit all your rights as a driver at that point. And you're giving up your right of way in that regard. This is where it comes down to with training and talking before about the helicopter and the sterile cockpit. I'd like to bring that up. I think we need to start looking at that as an industry. We are filling our driving compartments with so much technology and so many things that we are not paying attention to what we're doing, which is driving. And that leads us into other things. I don't know what she was doing, that she was distracted. She's a medic that's been on the job for quite a few years. She's not a novice to this. And it was a bad situation, unfortunately. She was at the wrong place at the wrong time, and she was distracted for a little more than 2 seconds. That's all it really takes. And when you take into account the driver that struck her, based on her age, and I'm sure she's got issues with her sight, whatever else, as 86-year-old people do, and we're all going to be there eventually, so I'm not knocking them, but you know, I'm sure her reflexes and everything has slowed down. So when she did see this, she didn't react in an appropriate amount of time as well. So it was just a lot of bad situations that all merged right there at that one intersection. And it's an unfortunate thing. But that doesn't take away from the fact that, again, we as a system have to recognize that the number one killer for EMS are motor vehicle collisions. And more likely, and the studies show that 82% of all the fatalities in ambulance collisions occur in the back of our ambulances. We're very lucky that the attendant in the back wasn't seriously injured or killed as well. I'd be curious to find out if that attendant in the back was actually seatbelted in.
From my understanding, they were not.
They were not. Which is, miraculously, he survived. Because all the odds were against him.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we're so apt not... Well, here, let me ask you. You know, there's five of us on here. How many of you routinely wear your seatbelts in back of the ambulance?
Nope.
I do.
How many calls a day do you run, Robert?
Well, Kyle, I'm retired now, so I can't. I have to be honest with you. I don't run any calls anymore. I've moved on in my career. But being a medic for 31 years, let me say that at the very beginning, I agreed with all of you. I did not wear my seatbelt in the back as well. And there's probably about 98% of the time you should be wearing a seatbelt or you can be wearing a seatbelt. It's that other small 2% of the time where you're actually involved in patient care that requires you not to wear a seatbelt. As I learned, as I went on to become an instructor, an EVOC instructor, an accident investigator, I now wear my seatbelt all the time. All the time in the back of that ambulance. Unless, of course, I'm actively engaged in patient care, such as CPR or something.
You know, and I agree with you, Robert. I've been trying to remember to do it. And just the way the seatbelts are set up in the ambulances, and half the time they don't even function right. And especially in the type 2 van ambulances, it's so uncomfortable.
You're
in such an awkward position. It's becoming difficult. And I think we need to start looking at changing the ambulance designs. Well, we've talked about this on previous podcasts before. But we need to start looking at that and the practices of what we're doing. Now, New York State, at the state level, is actually looking at putting together a document about to say what skills are done when on that. And I'm kind of wondering if we should start moving away from the whole load and go. You know, I'll do the infamous phrase, I'll do it on the way to the hospital, and stop doing it on the way to the hospital and take care of it, you know, before we get in the ambulance, if it really truly needs to get done. And maybe stop transporting cardiac arrest patients.
Absolutely, Kyle. Absolutely. And unfortunately, we can talk about safety in the back of the ambulance till we're blue in the face. I definitely should be wearing my seatbelt in the back of the ambulance. There are no excuses. I should definitely be wearing my seatbelt on the public bus. No excuses. What bothers me more, and Robert, maybe you know more stats about backing this up, but I was trying to do some research a little while ago about ambulance providers being injured and dying, but it seems like more of us are being injured in the cab of the ambulance not wearing our seatbelt than in the back. That's disturbing.
Well, Justin, it's interesting that you point that out, and the reason for that is because we spend most of our time in the cab of that ambulance. So when we are involved in collisions in the front of that vehicle and we sustain an injury versus it being in the back, yes, you're right. We do sustain more injuries, but that's only because I believe that we're up front more. And again, we're coming down to the situation of, are they wearing their seatbelts? What you have to also remember is that the way the vehicles are designed and they're built is that the front of our vehicles, whether it's a type 1 or type 2 or 3, is designed to meet crash standards of a utility vehicle basis set by IIHS and NHTSA, and nothing else. Everything 17 inches behind the driver's seat and beyond is not standardized and is not expected to withstand federal standards in crash collisions or crash tests. So we have an issue with that. The box isn't rated. The back of the van ambulance isn't rated. If you put a fiberglass roof on there and extend the roof, the height of the vehicle so you can stand up better, that now changes the integrity of the vehicle. And we lose all that. And it's not rated. There is no way a passenger car would be allowed out on the roads today if they folded and disintegrated under such minute conditions And yeah, I'm talking about 50-mile-an-hour collisions where a box ambulance is disintegrating. It becomes a big issue. It's only been recently that the standard has increased, and that's only because manufacturers are now hearing us scream about it. And they're taking their own initiative. But right now, there's still no federal standard governing what has to be, how it has to be built. And right now, unfortunately, the law provides that it has to, it falls under the same standards as an RV. So that's a problem that we're running into. The number one safety issue in ambulance design, ambulance driving, and everything is the driver. That is the number one safety element.
I agree 100%.
We need to start changing the mindset of our EMTs and our paramedics out there. You know, the old adage in the fire department is that if you see my tail end, you know, if you see my, the back end of my rig, you better be second due. Has anybody ever heard that one?
Yep.
Right? So, yep. You know, that's the wrong adage, is where we're racing to things. We have to beat each other out. And we need to start drilling it into their heads that you're running a cardiac arrest. You're doing CPR in the back of that ambulance. There is no reason you should be flying to the hospital.
It's a slow ride. I'll go one step back. There's no reason to be doing CPR in an ambulance.
I agree.
Well, with the new technology, but not everybody has it out there.
But why are we transporting them?
Exactly.
No.
I mean, if you look at the majority of the cases,
yeah,
you know, compared to the rare few, such as, you know, a hypothermic patient, you know, why are we, you know, transporting these, you know, dead people? We can really do about the same what the ER is going to do. And probably, I would happen to say, better.
Kyle, it goes back to not only can that person not do good CPR in a moving ambulance, but they cannot do it safely.
Absolutely.
In a moving ambulance. And if I'm going out as the captain that day and my crews say, you know, well, we don't have pulses yet, but we're going, my order is no. You're not going anywhere. Because we do not have the restraint systems to keep you safe while you're doing one-handed CPR in a moving ambulance. We're going to work here. We're going to work now.
Right.
And the compressions aren't nearly as effective with one hand.
Not at all effective. Not even nearly. And we've known that forever, but now we have the science to back it up, which is nice.
Right. And we have to remember that even when CPR is done 100% correctly, it's about 35% effective. So there is no way you could do 100% perfect CPR in the back of that ambulance. Getting back to the driver, it's his responsibility, just like in anything else, and we need to change their mindset. They're forgetting about that. We're cluttering the cockpit. We're not giving them a sterile environment where they only have to do is drive. We're running into situations. Kyle, it's going to go back to your scene survey, BSI. I don't know how old you guys are. I'm probably older than all of you, but I started way back in the late 70s. And you know what? When we worked on patients, we never wore gloves. Never. And, you know, we used to come back from the station. You had blood on your shirt. You had vomit on your pants. And that was a good night. That you brought back your work with you. And they drilled it into us through education that you have to wear gloves all the time. And, you know, we got into the whole BSI and scene assessment, inpatient assessment skills. And you did that, and through education, we now changed it. That even, and I only retired a year ago, that even now, you know, I don't touch anybody without putting a pair of gloves on. That's the way it is. And boy, I don't get a drop of anything on me. And that was going way back. So when that educational initiative started. But I don't know why we're not having a big push on the initiative for educating our EMTs and paramedics about safe driving. We're just not doing that.
I think it's a mindset.
I think it's a macho. There's still too much macho.
I agree with you. I want to get there before them.
Well, that's a good point. It is a macho thing because the majority of our drivers in EMS are under the age of 25. We're hiring a lot of really young EMTs and paramedics, I'm sure you and I, we were all started that. I know I started way below age 25. And studies have shown, medical studies have shown that the frontal lobe, which controls your judgment, your reasoning, your behavior, your forward thinking, all of these things, that frontal lobe doesn't fully mature until after the age 25. So when you look at things like this, you understand why insurance companies keep their rates up so high until the driver reaches 25. It's why you can't rent a car until you're 25, and so on. And they don't just arbitrarily pick a number. And yet we're allowing our volunteers and everything out there. Some of them, you can't drive till you're 21. Some of them allow them to drive when they're 18. And they have a very poor training curriculum. It's usually a four-hour lecture. And then it's drive me around the block once or twice, and then watch how I do it with lights and sirens before you get to get behind the wheel. And then, you know, remember, I forgot who quoted it, but and maybe one of you could tell me. But remember, it's a stupid person is the one who keeps doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results.
I believe that was Moses.
Albert Einstein?
Who? No, it was earlier than Einstein.
Earlier than Einstein, I'm sure. But I don't know about Moses, but okay.
I'm pretty sure it was the 12th commandment.
Yes, right?
It was broken off.
Thou right. shalt not oppose traffic unless it is truly a life emergency.
Yes.
Yeah, that was on the third tablet that Moses dropped.
Right. Exactly. Robert, if I can jump in here real quick, I completely agree with everything you're saying. We're not teaching these EMTs and paramedics, the folks that we're handing the keys over to people who we assume know how to drive. They might know how to drive, but they don't know how to drive under stress with lights and sirens and the responsibility that comes with. Right. And I don't know if you've had the opportunity to go over to Chronicles VMS under our conference updates. I had the opportunity in Dallas to sit down in a law enforcement driving simulator. Kyle Scott, RJ, I don't know if you guys have seen this video. But what I did is sat down in this law enforcement driving simulator and I said, you know, are we really distracted while we're driving? Well, let's find out. So I started driving, and I'm trying to interview the guy that runs the simulator. My phone is ringing. I'm trying to deal with the paramedic in the back who's telling me to hurry. I've got dispatch calling me on the radio. We are more distracted than we think we are when we're driving these giant machines. And like you said, the driver is kind of protected, but the folks in the back, they're not. And there's no standards governing them other than, you know, would they survive in an RV, right. like you said. It's going to cost a lot of money for services to put their people through proper EVOC training. Should we be trying to piggyback on with fire and law enforcement on driver training?
Absolutely.
For Code 3 response?
Absolutely. And let me just ask you a question. First of all, you said you were down in Dallas. You saw the driving simulator. Do you remember what company it was?
I want to say it was the IAAC. I can play the video right now and find out for you.
IES?
FAAC.
FAAC
was the manufacturer. Yes.
All right, Kyle. Kyle, Justin, I'm gonna put in a shameless plug here. That is who I am now working for.
No.
Yes, and let me tell you why.
Do I get to break into the Small World theme song right now, or no?
You know, unfortunately, it was not me down at Dallas, but I do know the instructor you were there with. You were with a guy named Chuck Deakins, tall guy, glasses. He was a law enforcement. He was a cop over in Santa Ana, California.
That's exactly who we were with. Now, folks, listening to the First Few Moments podcast, this was not a setup.
No, this was not a setup. Let me, Kyle, if you don't mind, I'd like to give you a little more background. Not so much about FAC, because I don't want to make this a shameless plug, although I'd like to. But I want to talk about that simulation training and the reason why I'm working for FAC. New York City, I was a paramedic lieutenant. I was in charge of our EVOC program from 1999 until 2009 when I retired. Till 2003, for the longest time, I was unable to reduce our accidents, our collisions. There was no way I could reduce them. We were having about 700 collisions a year Now, in New York City, we run about 300 ambulances citywide at any given time, and we respond to close to 4,000 runs in a 24-hour period. We handle about 1.2 million calls a year. So in that 1 year time, we would have about 700 collisions, ambulance collisions. And that would result in anything from simply a mirror being struck to a full blown out intersection collision with fatalities and, you know, lawsuits and disability and everything. Well, in 2002, we received a grant and we received money donated to us that we were able to go ahead and purchase a simulator. We shopped around, looked around. We found FAC. And they were probably one of the best companies out there, and I'm very happy that we did go with them. They developed and built us our driving simulator, and this thing was delivered to us in 2003. And to make a long story short, we started training our guys. We started to develop this. Now, we changed. The simulator taught us a few things. One, it showed us where we were falling and where we were having shortcomings within our own training. We recognized one of the issues. My driver training program was 5 days long at the time. It was increased to 7 days, and we had no reduction in intersection collisions or in collisions, period. So that was a big problem. We got our simulator. It identified to us that the majority of our students, which I told you before, were under 25. The majority of them had very little driving experience. Most of them were inner city people who took the subway or mass transit. Some people from upstate New York or from Long Island who did drive, and a very, very small percentage of them who were volunteers and had any kind of experience at this at all. What it identified was that the majority of them, believe it or not, do not know how to read a map. Maps, not knowing how to read a map, and forget about your GPS because it doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. And we all know that. You know, mm-hmm. You have to rely sometimes on your map. Most of the time you do. Map reading, believe it or not, the not knowing how to read a map will put you into a collision mode. It's guaranteed. Because what happens is you read the map, you say, I have to make a left, and instead you make a right in the real world. And you go 2, 3, 4 blocks out of the way, you make a mistake, you realize what you made a mistake. You have to now turn around and come back 2, 3, 4 blocks back to square one before you even respond. You've already into the call about 6 minutes response time, and you're still back at square one. So what happens, you start pushing through that intersection faster and faster. You're taking chances, you develop tunnel vision, you have a dispatcher who's requesting an update and badgering you on this until finally you put yourself into a collision. It's that simple. What we also identified in the using the simulator was that we were able to now recreate real-world experiences for them and put them into this situation before we put them into a real-world situation under stress. When is the best time to learn how to go through an intersection against a red light left of center? When you're doing it for the first time going to a real call, or when you're doing it in training? The real training. Answer to that is when you're in training. Of course, when you're in training. We never, as medics, you never learned how to run a code. When you did a code, you always learned on a mannequin first. You always learned how to do it in training. But we don't do this in our EVOC training across the country, except for a few places. So the simulator allowed us to put them into real-world situations, and they learned from their mistakes. And we all know that the human race learns better from their mistakes than we do from our successes. You watch any driver out there who tailgates on a regular basis, and they'll tell you, well, I don't have a problem because I've never hit anybody yet. Yet. That's the answer. Yet. Because they will eventually do that. And let me tell you, once you rear-end somebody, you realize it was because you were tailgating, guess what? You learn not to tailgate anymore. So we do that in the simulator, and we work on it with that. Because of the FAC training simulator and the training and the service that we received from the company, we were actually able to perform a study. And in an 8-year period, I was able to show 4 years prior to simulation training, 4 years after simulation training, that we had a 50% reduction in intersection collisions.
Amazing.
50%. Now, mind you, that's before great. The simulator, I was not able to reduce a collision by one. Now, here's the interesting part. We were doing 700 collisions the 4 years prior to the simulator. 700 collisions a year, 40% of them were intersection collisions. Well, 4 years study after simulation training showed that we were still doing 700 collisions a year, but only 20% of them were intersection collisions, because that's what we targeted on. I would rather have 700 collisions a year of all being a right mirror strike. I could fix that later, but I need to fix those intersection collisions right now. And
now, I'm Robert, sorry, real ahead. Quick, if I'm sorry, it's Justin here. If I can jump in real quick, how much of that can you attribute to the simulator, and how much might just be 4 years extra experience driving? Because it seems to me we put these brand new green EMTs not in the passenger seat, we put them in the driver's seat. And it's the medic's job to check the map, you know, formulate the treatment plan, and also at the same time, whoa, where are you going? You know, what are you doing? Were you able to take that into account in your study?
Yes, actually, and actually that's a good point, because what we really did, first of all, it was all of our new employees that got the training. And what we were able to show with that was the reduction in that was that we were measuring out people who were involved in collisions versus people who were not involved in collisions. And then we measured out, did they receive training on the simulator, or did they not receive training prior to the simulator? And we were able to show that the majority of the collisions out there were from people who had 3 to 5 years on the job. So it was basically our new employees.
Mm-hmm.
We also showed that the majority of the people having these collisions were under the age of 25, which again goes back to that medical study, which shows about the frontal lobe. We were able to also identify several causes. We took into account that we had additional units going up. So we were putting more vehicles out on the street. So if more vehicles are going out on the street and our call volume was also going up, therefore it would make sense that our collision rate would go up proportionately. But what we were able to prove and show in our study was that as much as call volume went up and more units went out on the street and they were not available more, and we were putting out more students, more new employees that were the cause of most of our collisions, we were able to still have a drastic drop in intersection collisions. And it was attributed, again, and we wrote a white paper on it and everything else that I'd be happy to share with anybody, but that we actually were able to attribute it mostly to the simulator. And again, because we put them into the situation. Now, you have to understand, the simulator is not a magic box. You don't put a student in it and they come out a perfect driver.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. It's another tool to be used, just like your life pack, just like your traction splint. It's up to the instructor to train with this appropriately. And I have to say, I had really great staff in the fire department, and we made things happen. And what they would do, a few of the things that we would do is that we would have the student would be put into a simulation that was basically a win-lose situation. If he made the right choices and the right decisions, he could win the scenario, so to speak, and get from point A to point B safely. But I'll be honest with you, most of the time, I didn't want that to happen. I wanted them to fail, believe it or not. It sounds counterproductive, but it's not. I want them to make their mistakes. I want them to do what they would have done in real life, and now they're involved in a collision. With that, we're able to back it up. We can critique it. We can replay it. We can have them redrive it. And now they've learned from their mistakes. The other consequences of it is that we talked about the ripple effect, which is that it's not just about this collision. It's not an isolated incident. You come from a small community where you only have 3 or 4 ambulances there, and now your vehicle is involved in a collision, and I have to dispatch 2 more, one to you and one to the original call. Guess what? I have tapped out all my resources. And most likely, we know the guys on the ambulance. So when they're involved in that collision, how do the rest of the responders respond in? They're flying. They've got real tunnel vision. They just had a cup of coffee with you back at the station an hour ago, and now you're screaming that you've been involved in a collision. Your partner's hurt. How do you think they're going to respond? How would you respond? You got to take chances. Most likely put us again into a greater risk of having another collision. So they need to understand that this collision that they've been involved in isn't just about them, and that the ripple effect takes place with that. Another aspect that I found quite interesting, that Prince William County down in Virginia, Prince William County Police Department also has a fax simulator. And the police officer there in charge of the training, what he does with his recruits is that when they're involved in that collision and he talks about that and how they've just now killed their partner, their homework assignment is to go home that night and write a letter to the widow explaining why their actions killed their partner, this husband. And they have to come back and read it to the rest of the class.
We have a huge issue with some of our partners where our guys won't wear the seatbelts. And I looked at the one guy and said, listen, you need to wear a seatbelt. He goes, well, why? Because if you die, I don't want to listen to your wife.
That's right.
And he looks at me, I'm like, wear your darn seatbelt. And I think some of it comes into the aspect, and this goes right back to, you know, the air medical. Everyone always, you know, it's kind of funny. All that stuff you learn in EMT class is like, yeah. You know, spend like 5 minutes on, like, you know, the scene safety issues and stuff like that. But when you go over to the air medical industry, that is really all that sort of stuff. That whole situational awareness is just driven into your head. And nothing more than the sterile cockpit. And I think we should start looking at that, Rob. I think we need to start looking at the and not in the classroom. I think us, everyone who's listening to this podcast, all of us veterans, have to start saying, this is what we're going to do now. And that when who's ever driving is driving, who's not driving is not playing on their cell phone, is not tapping on the computer. Their eyes are outside looking around. And those, you need 2 sets of eyes, you know, 2 pairs of eyes out looking out that window on the way to the call and clearing intersections and saying, hey, did you see that car up there on the right? He looks like he may be blowing out. And that when you need to look in to look at your computer or look at a map, you need to do something that we do in air medical, which was, eyes inside.
Right.
And when I say eyes inside, that now knows my partner, he knows to look, you know, and cover the area that I was covering. And I think that's what we need to start looking at doing, is taking the lessons from the air medical and applying them to how we operate our ambulances.
You're right. Yes. And that's been the focus of a few things right now. But, you know, to be honest with you, I don't know if we could truly get to the sterile cockpit aspect of it. But if we could start changing their mindset, like you're saying, and getting these people to wear their seatbelts, that's the most important thing. That's the start. That's a start.
If it takes negative reinforcement in some cases, then that's necessary. I worked for a company that we had the motion-activated cameras in all of our cabs.
Okay.
And God help you if that thing went off and you were playing on your cell phone, if you were driving and you were playing on your cell phone, or you didn't have your seatbelt on, because it would usually equal you'd spend a few days at home thinking about, you know, what was going on. And that it's something that I've pushed for here, and you know, we use simulators for recruit training and annual vehicle training. Is that, you know, it's hard to enforce, or it's hard to reinforce, I should say, instead of enforce, reinforce that idea of a sterile cockpit, of an undistracted driver. And if you got to use, you know, you got to use whatever you can. And in my mind, one of those is the drive cams. That seems to be one of the few ways that, you know, they can enforce that you need to be wearing your seatbelt. You shouldn't be playing on your cell phone. And because if this thing goes off and catches you, you know, it's indisputable. And, right. And if it takes that kind of reinforcement, then that's what it takes. And if it seems that important to put somebody off, you know, for, you know, 8, 12, or 24 hours, you know, then imagine what kind of message that sends. You know, so-and-so got suspended for, you know, 3 days for a repeated violation of the policy. And, you know, what kind of message does that send?
Right. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the drive cam is also another great tool. But, again, it's only a tool and only if it's used properly. I've seen some departments use it where they only looked at the camera's footage if the vehicle was involved in a collision. And that made no sense to me whatsoever, because most of the time the cameras are being tripped and are being triggered during non-collision type events.
Oh yeah.
And that's the best part, is that they're catching what the driver is doing that you're never knowing anything about. If you know your guy's bringing back their ambulance and it doesn't have a scratch on it or anything, you know, as far as you're concerned, they came back, everything was hunky-dory, there was no problems with it. But you don't know how many near misses or near fatals they almost had during that day.
Or how fast they were going when they took those train tracks.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So if you could look at those drive cams without having an accident or a collision, and it was a non-collision event, you could pull your driver in and deal with them with reinforcement. And again, it comes back to motivation. And there's two types, you know, extrinsic and intrinsic. But with the extrinsic motivation, what are we dealing with, the carrot or the stick? You know, some places try to throw a little pizza party or something if we have zero collisions for the week, or if you wore your seatbelt every single day or something like that. And other people, they just don't get it. We have to beat them with the stick, so to speak, and discipline them and, you know, take days away from them and so on until they finally learn. And then finally, some just get to the point where they're just such a liability, we have to let them go.
Right. And yeah. We've actually, and you were talking about mirror strikes, or you mentioned mirror strikes, is something that we've actually started doing in the ambulance redesign process, is to narrow the profile of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
In order to reduce mirror strikes, because those are, I think, Chief Ludwig put out some of our collision statistics, and it was like very few. I think less than 10% of our collisions were actual, like, you know, front or side collisions caused by, you know, emergency driving or something that, you know, involves vehicle to vehicle. A lot of our accidents involve mirror strikes.
Right.
And other issues like that. So we've actually begun the process of narrowing the profile on the vehicles in order. So we've created an engineering response or an engineering solution in addition to, you know, I'm really pushing a personnel solution to it as well, or a policy solution in addition to an engineering solution.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up also, because one of my pet peeves is with the automotive industry's response to behavioral issues and being fixed with engineering solutions. What you guys are doing sounds like a great thing. That's a whole different aspect. I give you the example of how the new cars identify that there's somebody in your blind spot by having a little light up on their side view mirror.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it's like, are you kidding? We've gotten to the point where we're too lazy to actually turn our head and check the blind spot, that we actually have to have this machine tell us that there's somebody in the blind spot. And
I just installed the convex mirrors.
Well, right. But again, you still need to check your blind spot. And that's a behavioral issue. And we're trying to fix it with an engineering solution. And that doesn't really work. Because every time we think we're fixing something with an engineering solution, we're not. All we're doing is we're telling the public, and we're telling our crews, you could push the envelope that much more. drove slower, you drove differently when you knew your vehicle didn't have ABS brakes. It didn't have power steering. It didn't have electronic stability control. Your roadways weren't super highways. And then as time, you know, advanced on, and we've developed all of these things, super highways, stability control, ABS, all of these functions, our vehicles are safer with airbags and seatbelts and pre-tensioning seatbelts, collapsible steering wheels,
crumple zone.
Crumple zones, all of these things. You know what they did? It simply told us we could drive faster. We could take more chances. We have more forgivingness with the vehicle and the roadway. That's why, again, I get to the point that engineering solutions are not the solution for behavioral issues. We need to fix those issues. Because with all of those issues that I talked about, all those advances in automotive technology, we are still killing over 42,000 people a year on the roadways.
Useless unless you teach the drivers how to use it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. So, you know, it comes into a whole play of things. We have more drivers on the road. We have faster and quieter vehicles. Remember, when they talk about, in the automotive world, when they talk about dampening environmental road noise, you're also talking about that means dampening your siren so they don't hear you. And we don't recognize that. We talk about tinted windows to talk about your lights will not necessarily penetrate as brightly through those tinted windows. So they're not hearing you, they're not seeing you. And you put in a 500-watt speaker system or even a 1,000-watt speaker system, their decibel levels with those bass and everything is higher than the sirens producing.
Oh, yeah.
So we have another issue right there. And then our drivers are sitting there saying, gee, how come this guy's not getting out of our way? Why did he not yield the right of way? We need to reinforce that. And I'll be honest with you, one of the best ways to do that I've learned is with simulation training. That's why I work for the company now. I mean, it was a no-brainer for me. What I learned here was that I developed what we call the triangle of training. Most of our departments, most services, we do an EVOT course. You get a 4-hour lecture or an 8-hour lecture or something. You get death by PowerPoint. And if you're fortunate enough, if you're one of those departments that have a field or something, you can maybe do a static cone course. Well, you know, that works on your dimensional analysis, and that helps with some vehicle dynamics, but not a lot. But it doesn't really work in crash avoidance or decision-making or judgment skills. And that's where the simulator comes in. And that forms that third leg of the triangle. So a lot of us are only giving out one or two sections of the triangle, and in simulation, we wind up adding that third leg. Simulation training doesn't replace EVOC. It doesn't replace the static course, the cone course, or anything like that. It's just a third tool that needs to be integrated into that system.
Absolutely. And I think with that said, we are going to wrap up this edition of the First Few Moments podcast. I want to thank everyone for coming, Rob. That was absolutely great. That's some great information. Mm-hmm. Really want to have you back on. You know, please join us whenever you see us on for that. It's a whole different view of that. And, you got to look at it. You know, I keep trying to think of ideas for topics, and we've hammered the motor vehicle crash and ambulance crash quite a few times, you know, within these last 18 episodes of the First Few Moments. And if you look on our website over at firstfewmoments.com and you look at the right-hand side, you will see that there are reports of ambulance crashes all over the place, and they just keep coming and adding and adding and adding on that. And, you know, I guess we can't talk about it enough. because we're still crashing, we're still dying, we're still killing people out there, and we need to be much more aware of what we're doing. We need to be aware of how we're driving and how we are functioning in that driver's seat. And at the same time, in that passenger seat, have all your eyes outside those windows, looking around, scanning. Plan ahead. If you do come inside, let your partner know, hey, listen, I'm looking inside. Drop those phones. Drop those text messaging. Try to stay off the computers, you know, if it's not part of the actual response. And, you know, take a few minutes before you actually pull out and look at where you're going. You know, I'm not a big fan of GPS. I'm a big fan of my map. It gives me a better idea as where I'm going, looking at all the other streets, and I pre-plan, you know, the whole response. So, for our panel tonight, Rob, where can they find you?
You can email me at rob@fac.com. You could also search for me on LinkedIn. I'm available there. I'd be happy to take you on as an associate, and right here on the podcast with you, Kyle.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Also, I'd like to also just put another shameless plug in.
Go ahead.
We have a textbook coming out by J&B Publishers, hopefully sometime this year. It's going to be on emergency vehicle operations. And hopefully you've all read my article in the November issue of Fire Engineering. And there'll be additional articles coming out in both Fire Rescue 1 and Fire Engineering. Mm. And hope to see you at FDIC in March.
Well, whenever you can send to me for links, Rob, we definitely will do that for you.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
Mr. Russell Stein, where can we find you?
Hybridmedic.com, Twitter, @Hybridmedic, Facebook, Hybridmedic blog. And then my usual Facebook page. That's about it.
Great. Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me again.
Yes.
On First View. The Happy Medic, Justin, out there in California.
As always, you can find me at thehappymedic.com on Twitter, thehappymedic. You can also find me at vimeo.com/15463814. Or you can also find Mr. KDB, Scott Keir, and Russell Stein in Dallas last year. I will be in Baltimore March 1st through the 5th, guest of Zoll Medical. I'll be in the booth. Come by and say hello.
Oh, great.
Zoll has been there for Chronicles from the beginning and keep stepping up for us. Also, look for me on the brand new firstrespondersnetwork.tv. We're taking fire, police, and EMS to a place they've never been before. So keep an eye out for new developments there.
Excellent. I was talking to Ted about that earlier today. So you guys got some great things going on. So thank you so much, Justin, for joining me. And finally, Mr. Scott Keir.
Mr. Kyle David Bates, thank you. You can find me on Twitter at MedicSBK or at my blog, EMS in the New Decade, which is 2010ems.blogspot.com. Or, of course, you can find me in Baltimore whooping up on the EMS Garage Darts team.
Thank you. I was going to bring that up. I was talking to Mr. Montero. I guess he was throwing down on the garage.
Really?
I guess he was. Unfortunately, we haven't been there to defend ourselves. You know, they're just a bunch of, you know, whiny, runny-nosed guys who lost. And Justin is witness to that defeat.
I was witness. I was scorekeeper. Now, guys, Wednesday night, we're having a big kind of meetup in Baltimore. Any details on that we can release right now?
We're looking, hopefully, in the next week. I just need to talk to a couple people, RJ and I do, and then we'll hopefully have everything in line by this week and know where we're going and when we're doing it and what's going on.
Well, I'll be coming folks, in Wednesday night.
Yeah, if you're coming into Baltimore, Thursday night is the big Fire EMS Blogs meetup. Last year, it was upstairs, kind of in that corner room at the Pizzeria Uno. This year, they've got us the entire restaurant, guys.
Oh, wow. Terrific.
But the night before that, Wednesday, it's all us.
Yes, it is. If anybody was in Dallas for the House of Blues excursion that we had that night.
Expect that was a great night.
We're in Baltimore. That was a terrific night, and we're looking to duplicate that and do that all over again.
I should be rolling in around midnight, so I'll have to get one of your phone numbers to see if you guys are still out. I'll drop the family off. And
I hate to say it, but KDB, you can hit me up on the Twitter, buddy.
That's right.
we will be live tweeting.
Excellent. I'll be driving down from Tonawanda, coming down Route 11, 15, down to 83, heading into Balmer.
Oh, I'm wrinkling my face.
Heading into Balmer. Balmer, Maryland, down there, where my family is from.
I finally joined the smartphone crowd, so I'll be live tweeting as well.
Oh, yay. Finally. Welcome, there you go.
Royd?
Yes.
Nice.
Excellent. So, for me, as I do tweet at Image Medic. You can find me at KyleDavidBates.com. You can find me here at the First Few Moments podcast. You can also find me over at my other project, PEDI-U.com, our sort of bi-weekly podcast for everything pediatric and small and drooling. Just did a great episode. RJ was there where we talked about pediatric head injuries and concussions on that. So that should be up in the next few days as well. So, folks, when you're out there, be careful. Be safe. Remember, you know, that you have to worry about your safety. Make sure that you manage your scene, triage everything, and do the appropriate care as necessary. But first and foremost, folks, be safe, because you need to go home at the end of your shift, all right, and have a constant sense of situational awareness. We'll be getting more of that out as these podcasts go on. So I want to thank you to my panel tonight, and thank you for listening. Have a good night.